Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck Knicks, what the fucksters, what the fuck Adelphians, what the fucking Knucks? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. I sound very clear to myself right now. I sound very clear. Welcome to the show. Today on the show, Mac McCann from Merge Records, the label, the long enduring and amazing indie record label. Also, one of the founding members of the band Superchunk, still cranking out the rock and roll, will be talking to me momentarily. Also, a little drop-in chat with Carol Leifer, the comedian and writer, about her new book, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Crying. So sort of a double header today. And I wanted to do a little business. I know it's Labor Day. A lot of you guys and gals aren't going to. That's so funny because I throw in the gals because I realize I use guys as a general thing. Like, hey, you guys, like everybody. That's men and women included. But then when I say, all right, you guys, there's part of me that goes, what about the ladies? All right, you guys and gals. I know it's Labor Day. You're probably going to listen to this at your leisure. It's going to be a little stilted because you're probably enjoying a barbecue or not really appreciating what Labor Day really means, but nonetheless, perhaps enjoying some free time, getting caught up on some shit, eating some food with the family, perhaps having another day of drinking, perhaps having another day of recovering from drinking, but nonetheless, you'll get to this eventually. And I wanted to give you a heads up on some of the dates I have coming up because I just added a bunch of some of you people who are in L.A. or visiting L.A. Enjoyed coming to my my Trippany House residency shows, which is it's a pretty low price ticket. It's pretty under the radar. I only tell you guys about it. I'll tweet about it a bit. But it's me just working out stuff and polishing some stuff and trying to find some new stuff. But as I head towards the tour next spring, and also towards some of the dates I have coming up at the in the New York Comedy Festival. I haven't been in New York in a couple of years, and I'm going to be there on November 7th. They just added another show at the Skirball Center at NYU. So I'm going to be doing two shows there, and I want it to be tight as fuck. I have this fantasy that I'm going to be tight as fuck. Yeah. I have this fantasy that my next special is going to be called Mark Maron Structured Surprised. But I wouldn't count on that. But nonetheless, some of you came to the Trippany House shows before and saw me work on some stuff. I'm going to be working on that stuff and I'm sure some new stuff. But those dates at the Trippany House are September 16th, 23rd, and 30th, and October 14th and 21st. If you go to WTF Pod and go to the calendar, you can get that, get a link to those tickets. They're usually a cheap ticket. I do it for a benefit for the theater. Also, this Friday, September 5th, I'll be at the Nevada City Film Festival doing some shows. Or a show. I'm not even clear if I'm doing one or two, but I should know that. And then the oddball dates still are coming up. And also we got the the Los Angeles Podcast Festival again this year on the 27th, which is my birthday. I'll be doing a live WTF, and there's a lot of stuff going on there at the LA Podcast Festival. You can sort of spend the weekend, get a package deal. And we got my podcast, More Stories with Jay Moore. Death Squad's going to be there. Never Not Funny with Jimmy Pardo. Risk with Kevin Allison. Jonah Radio with Jonah Ray. The Dollop with Dave Anthony and Gareth Reynolds. Improv for Humans with Matt Bester. The Todd Glass Show. The Dana Gould Hour. All going to be at LA Podfest. That's September 26th through 28th at the Sofitel Hotel in Beverly Hills. You could go to lapodfest.com. And it's a fun weekend. Everyone had a blast last year. So, all right, so that's a little business out of the way before I get to Carol Leifer. I have this weird relationship, as many of you know, with this deaf black cat that comes around. And I don't know, my schedule had gotten sort of erratic, and he's a real wild little fucker. And he's always sort of scraggly looking. And I hadn't seen him in 3 weeks, and I just assume, my assumption being, somewhat a realist, but also... you know, a bit of a worrier and full of panic is that, you know, if I don't see him, you know, I know I just feel like he's probably been taken by the wild and has met some violent and lonely animal end. And then he shows up and he's looking good, folks. And quite honestly, as I've shared with you before, it bothers me that he refuses to fully acknowledge that I am important in his life. But in all sincerity, it's good to see him. And there's just points where, you know, these relationships that I have in my life with these animals, where you kind of assume that they're gone forever and then they come back and, you know, there's relief. But there's also sadness and not knowing where they are. But that's just the way it is. I don't know. Should I put together some strange kind of feral cat codependency group here in the neighborhood for people who have relationships? Like, I'm sure he's got benefactors all over the neighborhood. I'm sure there's plenty of people that are standing, at their back window going, I wonder if that black cat's coming back. I hope he's okay out there. Why shouldn't we be talking? Do you understand what I'm saying? Why shouldn't we be talking? So this was actually pretty exciting that Carol Leifer asked if she could come back on. Carol Leifer, one of the great comedians, started out with Paul Reiser and Jerry Seinfeld and those people. That was her crew, Larry David and the like. Well, she's written this great book, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Crying. And she came by to talk about the book and talk about comedy. And I always love seeing Carol. So let's go to that.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Now, Carol Leifer is back. She's back in my garage because she has this amazing book. It's a memoir, but it actually does serve as sort of an advice book.
Yes, yes.
How to succeed in business without really crying. Lessons from a life in comedy. But it is a memoir, and I'm surprised that I think people who want to do this should read it.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. I'm really overwhelmed by the response.
Really? What's happening?
Well, you know, I got great response to my first book, but this book, I'm getting so many messages from people that are like, thank you for writing this. It's really given me a roadmap of what I want to do. I'm not even in show business and it's helping me. And thank you. And I wish you had written this, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And that really is nice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of these jobs where a lot of people who want to do these kind of things, these kind of jobs, think like it's ridiculous,
yeah,
not practical.
Uh-huh.
But I think the book speaks a lot to knowing what you want to do, figuring out how to do it, and following your heart and doing it.
Absolutely.
And comedy's rough, but anything's rough if it's off. But where is there job security anymore?
Yeah, there is none.
Right.
And when you have a passion for something, you just have to go for it. And I talk a lot about tenacity and stick-to-itiveness because, you know, I've been doing stand-up since I was in college. I mean, that's how long I've been doing this.
There's pictures of you in there, just like little Carol on stage with the appropriate hair for the time.
Right.
But when there's those pictures of you and Reiser and Jerry Seinfeld in his first apartment,
uh-huh,
that's crazy.
I know.
I can't, like, it's so weird to picture just a bunch of Jewish kids.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out how to do stand-up in New York City, because I was one of them.
Yeah.
Never changes.
I know, and I always feel like if I hadn't met Paul in college, because we were in the same theater group together, I don't know if I would have found the road to stand-up, because he was the person who told me, oh, there are these comedy clubs in Manhattan, and told me about auditioning and all that. And I always felt like you need that person who kind of brings you into the fold, or else how do you find it?
It's funny. He was the first guy that I ever asked how to do stand-up.
Really?
I don't know if I told you that.
No.
He was, I was in college, and he was in, Diner was already out, and
okay,
I had gone to the comic strip when I was in New York City. I was come down from Boston, and I saw Paul Reiser sitting in one of those booths.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, that's Paul Reiser, you know, and I was excited.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to him, and I'm like, you know, Mr. Reiser, I really want to do stand-up. I mean, how do I get started? And he looks at me, and he just says, well, you just got to do it.
That's right.
That was it.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
That was it. But I think also what's interesting about your career is that, because when you when you do stand up, and it took me years to realize this, all you want to do is stand up. And you really don't think, I mean, acting, yeah, but you know, you want to do stand up.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think about, I didn't anyways think about writing for television or producing television or figuring out other skills that I might have that relate to doing comedy. I was like, I'm going to be a stand up.
Yeah.
Which is a little limiting and hard to do for the long haul.
It is. But what I think has really been nice, I'm fortunate with my career, is I always give great respect to the stand-up because it really is the thing that gave me everything. I mean, it gave me a writing career because I'd never written for sitcoms, but I was, you know, went way back with Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld to literally my first day of show business. You know, Jerry passed me and Paul on the audition at the comic strip.
He was in charge.
He was the MC.
Yeah.
And Larry David was the MC at Catch Rising Star. So I go that far back with these guys. And when they were specifically looking for people who'd never written for sitcoms before, and, you know, to them, corrupted by the system of bad sitcoms, I got a great break. So, you know, even my corporate speaking that I do now, which I love, came from my stand-up. So I give it a lot of respect.
No, of course. But, like, I think a lot of guys get myopic, you know, like I did.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'm not going to write. I do my own stuff.
Yeah.
And I ended up in my garage broke 5 years ago. So that there's always that possibility. Because,
but, you know, but you did something that's very important that I do talk about in my book. I mean, you took the reins.
Right.
You know, you didn't give up.
Right.
You saw that you were good at something.
Right.
And you went after it and created it. And look at everything that has come to you as a result.
It's all from stand-up. I wouldn't have been anywhere without stand-up.
Mm-hmm,
and I still consider myself a stand-up. To the point where if someone says that you're a great interviewer, there's part of me that's like, yeah, but, you know, you just saw me do stand-up. I mean, how...
Take the compliment.
That's another
As
lesson.
As my mother would say.
Is that in the book? Take the compliment. don't question the complimenter.
Well, I do quote my mother, of course, being a Jew, because also another big part of my philosophy for staying in the business and staying alive in the business is, you know, the old, you don't ask, you don't get.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is really important because it's also a fine line between not being a pain in the ass, squeaky wheel, you know, that someone looks the other way when you come, but also kind of going after what you want. And there is a way to ask people nicely for things or approaching people.
That's right.
And standing up for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, without being annoying.
Right.
It helps if you have talent.
It helps if you have talent. Yes. Yes. It helps if you have talent. And you also have to not be afraid of no.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a hard one.
I mean, going on this press tour, I've approached people about if my publicist couldn't get me on a certain show, I'll reach out to the host of the show and say, hey, it's me. I'm having trouble getting on the show. I'd love it if you could make it work. If you can't, no problem.
Did that? It worked.
It has worked so far. Yes. Knock wood.
Well, the other thing that you're saying, too, I think about like about Jerry and about Larry and about something I realized in being in this business for a while is that it's important to maintain relationships as well with people that you like, because a lot of times, you know, people come up together, and if somebody gets an opportunity and you're in the wheelhouse of what they need, they're going to think of their friend first. They're going to think also of people they respect and they know. It's just, I never really maintained relationships because I was a lone wolf and I burned bridges. That was my style. But it's nice to keep in touch with people.
Absolutely. And being social and... I think a good egg, you know, comes back to. I mean, look, I'm out pitching a show, a sitcom with Ben Silverman, and we go to NBC, and who do I pitch to but my agent's former assistant?
Oh, that happens.
All the time now.
Oh, my God.
I mean, thank God. I'm nice to agents' assistants because I feel for them. But if I had been a real prick, that would have been the most uncomfortable pitch. Having her look at me like, oh, it's payback time,
that's
bitch.
That's right, that's right.
Here we go.
Yeah, and nice to see you, Carol. Thanks for coming in. Bye.
I'm going to take your pitch, and then I'm going to pass on it, fucker.
Yeah.
How about that?
Exactly.
Yeah, that was for the chop chop. Let's go get my agent on the phone.
Yeah, I've been that guy. I never did it right. So I think I should read this book more thoroughly. I love I read the piece about Soupy Sales because I had a similar thing with where you just, you know, there's something about being in show business, and when you're young, there's somebody that's going to like make you like,
yes,
that's my guy.
Uh-huh.
Mine was Buddy Hackett.
Oh,
I wrote to Buddy Hackett.
You did.
I wrote to Buddy Hackett, and he sent me an autographed picture.
Wow,
isn't that weird? And now knowing the kind of life that Buddy Hackett led, and like who might have sent me that picture. But you actually went and saw, you went to where you heard that Soupy Sales ate. You read it in a magazine, you and your family. That's nice.
I loved Soupy Sales. I would rush home from school to watch him. I read in a magazine that he used to eat at the Minetta Tavern, which I believe is still in the village. There.
Yeah, it's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I asked my parents if we could go. And really looking back now, instead of them being, you know, horrible parents and saying, honey, there's no chance the Soupy Sales is going to be a Minetta Tavern. You read a We got dressed up. We took the Long Island Railroad. We went to Minetta Tavern. My father looked at the bill. I'm sure he was like, paying the inflated village prices.
Yeah.
And, of course, he was not there, but still, it, you know, it was amazing that I look back now that my parents were nice enough and sweet enough to, like, honey, if you think he might be there, let's go.
Oh, they were supportive.
We'll get some linguine and clam sauce and check it out.
And you're sitting there waiting for Soupy.
Yeah, oh. I know. But stuff like that, I think is important. You know, even that I left college, I finished college, but that I left going to school in Binghamton to start this crazy career of stand-up comedy.
And you went back and finished?
I went to Queens College, so as you know, Mark, in my joke, Queens College, very tough. You need a pen to get in. So I finished my last year. It's so funny. I did Bill Maher and I did all my jokes, you know, slamming Queens College. Of course, the first, call I got Monday after Maher was like, will you perform at homecoming? So I'll be there in October, folks.
Are you really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so, I'm excited about that.
That's interesting.
Well, actually, I'm very grateful to Queens College because in those days, I did an internship that was like, I had a professor was like, you know, talk about your stand-up comedy, write a journal. I would like to hear tapes every now and then. And it really helped me a lot.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, I really think it was very cool of them to let me do that course.
Are you going to do stand-up or are you going to talk? I mean,
I'm going to speak.
Right.
Yes.
That's
Queens.
Better.
But it will be funny.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I think
because I couldn't imagine. I don't know who goes to Queen College or what it looks like now. But
yeah.
I imagine that you going and doing the half hour would be a little tricky. Sometimes, like, you know, I don't know what kids are thinking.
Well, it's a alumni homecoming, so
it's all cool.
It's all
That's
good.
It's great. Yeah. You're a graduate. That did good.
Yeah.
So let's go through the, if you were, and I imagine you've talked about this before in terms of, like, if you were to see this as some sort of beat-by-beat system to keep plowing through, I it seems to me that, you know, well, doing stand-up, you know, having the courage to do what you want to do and trying it and then sort of persevering or sticking
yes.
with it
mm-hmm.
long enough to see if you can do it.
Right.
But then, you know, when there must have been some dark times.
Absolutely.
Where you're like, how am I going to get work? I mean, you talk about auditioning, which is a nightmare.
Well, I talk about, you know, I got on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, which makes a great story
mm-hmm.
sitting here and talking about that. But I wrote about it because it took me 22 auditions to get on.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. 20 fucking two. And, you know, as a comic, after maybe the seventh time, you're like, okay, this is getting a little ridiculous.
And
I get
it, guys. And that was all there was. I mean, at that time, mm-hmm. I mean, what year did you do it? It wasn't like there was a million other showcases.
No,
that
I
could
auditioned
validate
for the
you.
First time in 1980.
Right.
And then I got on in 92, right before Johnny left. And I was doing the Letterman show this whole time.
Right.
But I still couldn't crack The Tonight Show. But every, you know, so I talk a lot about tenacity and stick-to-itiveness. Because, you know, audition number 22, if you think I wasn't ready to say to them, are you fucking kidding me? Really? One more time you want to see me? And then it put it over. So who knows?
Yeah, you don't know.
And
you don't know. You know what I'm finding is that you don't know why the decision is made.
You never know.
You don't know why the other 21 decisions were made. You don't know, like, if Johnny even knew who you were or who was stopping you.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to, you know, to think like some sort of larger entity is stopping you. But sometimes it's just one asshole.
It can't be that. It's one asshole.
You know, it's like when you get insulted on the internet. It's not the internet.
Yeah.
It's just one asshole.
One person, one unhappy, cowardly person.
That's right. Who has power.
Yeah. But even out of the worst, darkest valley, and I write about it in my book, can come the greatest moment of your career.
Like what?
For example, I was really at a horrible point in my stand-up, working terrible places. I met this new agent who was like, come to my office and write down your gigs and how much you got. We went through it and he was like, oh, you know, you got this at Ho-Ho's, I can double that. You know, you got this at Sir Laugh-A-Lot's, I can triple that. Anyway, cut to 6 months later, literally, Mark, I'm working on the Jersey Turnpike, doing ground round restaurant comedy nights, okay, where they can't even hear your jokes because the din of the peanut shells as they're shelling them on the floor, okay?
Horrible.
And I'm saying to this guy, like, where's the great gigs? He's like, Carol, I'm working on Frank. And I'm like, who, Frank Stallone? Because at this point, I don't see anything happening.
He was Frank Stallone's agent? What do you mean,
he
Frank?
He was working on Frank Sinatra.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
Trying
I
to open for him?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this guy is out of his mind. And then he got me, you know, I'm still working on this turnpike and this exit. And sure enough, I'm working on a cruise ship.
Yeah.
And you know, in those days, if you got a phone call on a cruise ship,
yeah,
you know, one of your parents croaked,
yeah, right,
or your house burnt down, yeah, and he said, I got you opening for Frank Sinatra in Vegas at Bally's Hotel.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he had a weird direct line to Jilly Rizzo, and it remains my greatest show business memory because not only was it, you know, interfacing with greatness, and he was such a gentleman and such a pro, and you know,
yeah,
I mean, it's amazing memory, but it came out of this dark hole of depression.
Like ground rounds in a boat.
Yeah.
It was over. There's no better metaphor for like a career ending than to be out on a boat.
I know.
It's like you're not even, yeah, grounded. How long did you open for Frank for?
I did, I think it was 5 shows. Yeah, it was a weekend in June in 1989. And, you know, I was nervous about it, obviously, because it's like, oh, God,
Frank Sinatra.
The crowd's going to eat me up. And I called Larry Miller because, yeah, Larry Miller had opened for him. And he was like, Carol, you've got it completely wrong. They're looking at you like you're Frank's girl. Go out there with that confidence. And I did. And I would open the show with, good evening, everyone. And I was so happy when Mr. Sinatra asked me to join him here at Bally's. And it really set the tone for the sets. And I have to say that I still kind of use that trick when I open for someone in a little bit of a scary situation.
Right.
Like, I take ownership. I was glad when so-and-so, yeah, asked me to
gratitude.
Join him. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that they're comfortable. And it was amazing to watch him backstage, to watch him be like any performer when it's a hot crowd, performing a little more, opening, yeah, up a little more when they're a little tight, pulling back a little bit. But he brought me out every night for a bow.
Uh-huh.
How amazing,
oh, that's
that.
Sweet.
And he also said some cryptic things. I mean, he was like, that's Carol Leifer. She's big. She'll knock you over for the phone. Okay.
She'll knock you over for the phone?
Yeah. I still do not know what he meant, but thank you for the compliment, Mrs. Sinatra. And then one time he said, there's Carol Leifer. Wish my mother had been that funny. I wouldn't have had to work so hard. The summer wind came rushing in.
What?
And then he started.
What? Did you like think, like, is this Buddha? Do I have to decode this? What does it mean? I can't. Well, I think that's also an amazing thing about this business that I've talked to a lot of people, but no one's really talk about it. But I talk about it where you're with another entertainer, where these are guys you grew up, you know, you came up with, like Bill and Larry and Paul and Jerry, who are, you know, huge acts now. But there is something amazing just knowing that we're just people.
Mm-hmm.
And then that moment where you're all waiting to go on stage in a big venue, or,
yeah,
you're at someone else's show.
Right.
And that guy, you know, like,
uh-huh,
just a guy.
Uh-huh.
And then he's out there in front of like thousands of people.
Yeah.
And it's like there's something so magic about it. I can't even explain it.
It's wild, isn't it?
Yeah, because I'll sit next to people, like if I do a live show, or even if you do Conan or any of those shows, or Letterman. This is just a guy.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what it is.
Uh-huh.
I still can't understand the magic of it. I mean,
right,
it just comes from time, but it's so cool to be in show business sometimes.
It really is.
Especially
and
when
also,
you're standing right backstage and you're just watching,
yeah,
the transition,
cool,
from like you know whoever you're standing there with, or even if it's you, they bring the person up.
Yeah.
And it's just like it's show business.
I know.
You got to love show business.
But I talk a lot too about the camaraderie among comics,
mm-hmm,
which there is and built in. I talk about this story where I went to do this corporate gig. And I came by myself, like I'm sure you do without your agent or manager, and show up. And I see the mic on stage and the stand. And then I'm like looking for the follow spot. And
right,
I say to the tech guy, like, excuse me, I'm the act and I don't see the follow spot. And he looks at me like, oh, sorry, Cher. We don't have your spotlight. And I'm looking at him like, no, you understand. It's kind of important when you do a show in a dark room that you have a spotlight. He's like, well, we don't have it. So I'm like, all right, great. I'm going to, you know,
yeah,
start to think, all right, I'll figure out how to do this now. Joan Rivers comes in. Because she was going to bring me on just for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It was so perfect, Mark, because she walks into the room, she sees me, says hello, she looks around, she goes, where's her follow spot? the tech guy's face like fell. And she's like, are you kidding me? You don't have a follow spot even for me up there to bring her on? She did 10 minutes before she brought me on of like, if you are not nice to this Carol Leifer, I'm going to kill you guys because this is so unprofessional. It was the greatest thing.
Yeah, it validated.
And only another comic understands.
That's right. And one with a little juice.
Exactly.
Who doesn't have anything to lose.
Yeah.
It's nice when they come to your defense.
Right, you said it. But that's another thing I shared, you know, something Jerry Seinfeld told me. There's not just one thing.
Right, exactly.
Like when I had my sitcom, All Right Already, on the WB, you know, the day before, the day of the shooting, you know, that we were going to shoot it that night, the taping, Jerry came by. He could see I was a wreck. And he was like, Carol, there's not just one thing. And I was like, you're bumming me out, okay? Because I'm going to be taping my pilot. He's like, I don't mean it that way. It's like, look at it as another day in the career of Carol Leifer, because there'll be many more days like this and many more nights. It's not the one thing that's going to catapult you.
That's it. That's that thing. Like, this is not it. Your life goes on.
Mm-hmm. And same thing. Focus on your work. Focus on what you're doing. Give a great performance tonight.
Yeah.
But it ain't the be all end all.
Right. So at this point in your career, I mean, you've been a stand up. You've had your own show. You've written on other shows. You've written for the Oscars. You've done all this stuff. You have a life. You're respected.
Yes.
You're doing corporate events. You're a writer. I mean, and I don't know that you would have imagined at the beginning, like where you're like, I just want to be a comic, that, you know, the way your life has gone.
Yeah. No, it's really nice. And what I do really love about it is there is nothing better than stand-up. Stand-up is great. But there are times then when you get tired of traveling and you get lonely. And then to be in a comedy writer's room with your buddies and laughing, and that social thing is fantastic. And then you want to go away a little bit and write a book and be solitary. So it's great to like mix it all up.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the things that in my experience in talking to creative people and knowing that creative people listen to this is that Your belief in yourself is going to fluctuate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but like at some point, if you're lucky and also a bit cursed, you realize like, well, I got to do it. I got to keep doing it.
Yeah.
That's the biggest leap that I think people have to make is this. If you're creative and you want to live the life of a creative person, that there are paths or ways to do it. But ultimately, it's going to come from tenacity.
Absolutely.
One way or the other.
Yes.
Whether you end up being the biggest stand-up in the world, you end up being a writer, whatever it's going to be, if you have a talent and you can figure out what the fuck it is, figure out how it can apply to whatever it is you want to do.
Right.
And sometimes you have to make compromises.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with making compromises if you're still honoring what you want to do.
Yeah. And I mean, all those, you know, there are still those, you know, it's not just one thing, examples every day. I mean, with my book, I knew the New York Times is going to, you know, review me. And then, you know, that's the sleepless night. Like, what if New York Times hates my book, you know? And then you get obsessed about it. And thank God they love my book.
But, oh, good.
You know, but that, even if they didn't, it's like life goes on, you know, you move forward. But there's always those things, and you control what you want to control and can control, and you screw the rest.
That's
because
right.
You'll, you know, that will eat you up.
And don't let it crush you if you're disappointed.
And right. Yes, exactly.
Disappointment's part of life.
And especially in this business, I mean, it's minimum daily requirement.
Always.
Yeah.
You know, there's a. It's just one of those things where you always assume that the people that you're jealous of or the things that you want that other people have. There's this weird idea that like, well, they've got it made, and then you know you get to meet them and you're like, no, they're not that. They're not that happy. I don't like it. If that guy's got everything and that's how. Yeah.
Right. If that's everything, I'll take everything.
I'm gonna have to figure out what my everything looks like. Well, thanks for coming. And I'm so glad the book is doing well.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me back, Mark.
I'm sorry it took so long. I've been busy.
No, I know.
I wasn't trying to avoid you, but the 9 emails helped, Carol.
Stick-to-itiveness, squeaky wheel. Right. Not being a pain in the ass, finding the balance.
Yeah. And never once did I go, what does she want from me? All right. Just have her over. When to schedule it. It's always good to see you.
Love you.
All right, you guys, I'm, you know, I was in a relationship and, you know, relationships for me, obviously, as many of you know, have been all variations of difficult, but this one was actually going pretty well. And you know, and I've been, you know, quite honestly, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but you're my audience, and I've been keeping my private life private, you know, for a change, so I can actually have a private life. And I'm sorry to cut you folks out of the loop, but I was finding that it put an added strain on the situation when I invite a few hundred thousand people into the room as a second and third and 300th set of ears. So, you know, but you know, I had hinted at it, but I was seeing someone in another state, and you know, it's just like, it was great, and it just became too hard, you know, and it started to seem unfair to both of us, you know, the distance, you know, which for me, I actually initially was great because it didn't enable me to enmesh immediately and then sort of annihilate any sort of possibility of real intimacy. And, you know, we were able to spend a lot of time talking to each other on Skype and stuff. But the thing was, is just that the distance is also, like, sadly, was the thing that ended up making it, you know, very difficult to maintain. You know, longing is very frustrating, and commitment is like, sadly terrifying to me at this point in time. And I don't know really how to deal with making practical decisions when there is like just so much emotion involved. And, you know, and this person's a great person. And I'm just, there's part of me that's actually beginning to understand why people stay in things that may not be that good or great, or just decide to be alone, because the pain of beginning and ending things is fucking awful. And it's wearing my heart down. And I, you know, I can feel myself becoming cynical, and it's like, it's a fucking nightmare. It's just one of these things where why can't I just let go and get to that place of real intimacy? I don't know, because I got work to do. I don't know, man. I think I'm just going to pull back and try to figure out what I really want. How would that be? It's not bad to be alone, right? As long as you're not lonely, right? I mean, I don't know. You know what? I'll ask my cats. Yeah, that's good. That's what I'll do. I'll ask my cats. It's okay, you guys, right? We're okay. You know what? I'll ask Deaf Black Cat when he comes back around. How would that be if he comes back around? See, there's no shortage of longing, and ever. But so I'm a little heavy-hearted. I imagine some of you can read that. Some of my more perceptive things. But look, I'll talk to my cats about it, and everything will be all right. So I'm happy to have Mac McCon here today. You know, he was there, man. Years ago, I lived with a dude in Boston that was running his own label called Vanishing Point Records. His name was Stan Monroe. He's actually out in Carolina too, but he got out of the only band on his label was his band. And just what he went through to try to run a label, to get the vinyl out, and this was before it was easy to work on the internet, just, you know, boxes and boxes of records of a band that nobody heard of, trying to fucking get some traction. I mean, it is a massive undertaking, and it's pretty fascinating that not only has Mac sustained Merge Records, but sort of adjusted it with time to the market and to the needs of artists, but he's also, you know, been putting out records with Superchunk forever. So, you know, we're going to have a conversation about that. It's really a conversation I've not had on the show. The conversation about running a label. Let's go to that now. Yeah, well, I mean, we've been trying to talk for, a couple years now? I'm not even sure how the relationship began.
Of course it began because I was a fan.
Uh-huh.
And knew that you liked music, and I think maybe got in touch to see if we could send you some.
Yeah, you sent me some, then music. You did some ads. Well, you know, Superchunk, your band, has been one of those ever-present bands. It's one of those bands that started at the time where everything, like, where punk was sort of like evolving into this other thing, and then there was always a Superchunk album, always. how many albums are there, seriously?
I think there's
your band.
I know. It's funny because I tried to come up with this number for my kids the other day because they're like, Dad, how many albums do you have?
Yeah.
It's like, I think there's 10 studio albums and then several collections and EPs and things like that, you know. Because I always liked bands that, when I was growing up, you know, in high school, buying records, I always liked bands that were constantly putting stuff out.
Yeah.
Like, there'd be a new album, but then there would also be some other single that you're like, what is this on another label that's like, you know, got to get that, you know,
right.
just kind of spraying stuff out there.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden there'd be these releases like from like before they were the band you knew.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, what they were doing things then?
Oh, I was.
Who's that guy?
I would buy like records by Bon Scott's band before AC/DC.
Get the fuck out. Now I need that record. I don't even know about that. What do you mean Bon Scott's other band?
You know, because those guys were all in like garage bands and things like that, you know, beforehand.
Now, Supertunk is your band, and John Worster, who a lot of my fans know from Sharpling Show, and I didn't really put it all together. Like, you know, Supertunk was always there for me, but and not until you started sending me records that I have to go sort of like reckon with Supertunk. Like, there's a big chunk of music that somehow I just fucking missed because I was locked into a more mainstreamy music mode when you were out, you know, punk rocking.
This is like in the 90s, you mean?
Probably. Like, yeah. I don't know if it was that music wasn't as important to me after high school for a few years there. I mean, I remember when Nevermind came out.
Sure.
And I remember when, that I started to get really back into it then, but I seem to have missed a whole lot. But when did you start playing?
So we started, Supertunk started in 89. And we started the record label Merge at the same time.
But you were going, like, I got the book.
But we had bands before that.
Right.
I was in bands before that starting in high school. I was in bands starting in, you know, 1983 or something like
that. Right, but this is in North Carolina?
In North Carolina. So I was in bands in high school and then
83.
High school and then in college.
So you're in high school?
Yeah.
And junior high?
High school and junior high.
And you always play guitar?
It's weird. I always played trumpet. And then in like school band, you know,
yeah.
And then oddly enough, my sister, who I don't think has touched a guitar since then, was taking guitar lessons.
Yeah.
And so she had an acoustic guitar around and I just started playing her acoustic guitar.
Right.
And trying to teach myself, I think it was AC/DC songs. I think I bought a songbook, an AC/DC songbook.
Nice.
And started to teach myself guitar that way.
Yeah.
And then I took a couple lessons at the mall, at the music store, Pearson Music in the mall, and bought a knockoff SG because Angus played an SG.
Yeah!
And so that was my first guitar. And I took a couple lessons and the guy kind of gave me the basics and then I didn't really take any lessons after that. And then I was in bands and got into punk rock after that.
Punk rock made it easy.
It did.
So you just have one sister?
I have a sister who's 3 years younger and a brother who's 8 years younger.
8 years younger?
Yeah.
Whoops.
And he's a drummer.
Really?
And he plays drums for Bon Iver.
Oh, I have that record, a couple of their records.
Yeah.
But, okay, so you're growing up in North Carolina. That is officially the South, correct?
Yeah, well, I was born in Fort Lauderdale and we lived there till I was 12. And then we moved to North Carolina.
Yeah, lucky you got out. You would have been a different man.
You know, it's so weird because I totally agree. But at the time, like, I could not believe that we were leaving Fort Lauderdale. Like, we lived on a canal near the beach, and it was like 70s Lauderdale, I think, was way different than 80s Lauderdale, or certainly now, whatever it is.
The problem with Florida is that, like, what defines Florida? I mean, is there a Florida sound? I mean, you would have been lost. You would never have found
it. Well, that's what's so funny is that, like, I remember distinctly being angry with my parents because I was like, we're moving to North Carolina. No bands play in North Carolina. There's going to be no... Like, I was so convinced that, like, Lauderdale got all the great concerts because I had seen Molly Hatchet or whatever, you know? And I was like, I can't believe we're moving to this backwoods. Like, I just had this idea of it
right.
that was so, like,
How
wrong.
How am I going to see Molly Hatchet?
Yeah. And so it's ironic.
Did you really see Molly Hatchet?
Oh, that was my first arena concert, yeah.
Three guitars, man.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. God damn.
Beating the odds tour.
Yeah. Wow.
And so, right, so, like, I was really bummed because, like, here, like, we live by the water, and, like, Florida, my grandparents are from there, my dad was from there, my mom, like, they're all from Florida, and so, like, I had this real, it's very imprinted on me, even though I recognize what's weird and terrible about Florida, but at the time, like, I loved it so much and didn't want to leave. Of course, as you say, like, oh my God, I'm so lucky that I didn't end up trying to be in a punk rock band in Florida.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are some great ones, were some great ones then, but in the early 80s, North Carolina and the South, like, was kind of an awesome place to be for music, it turns out, you know, which I, there's no way I knew that.
What kind of business was your dad in that he's moving around?
My dad is a lawyer, and he had a firm with my grandfather in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah.
And then when my dad was, I guess he would have been 40,
yeah.
he had a stroke.
Yeah.
And his doctor was like, and he recovered from the stroke, but his doctor's like, you need to do something less stressful than what you're doing now, and you need to live in a less stressful place. Because Lauderdale was super crime-ridden at the time, and they're like, all right, they both gone to Duke in Durham, and so I remember my dad like went to Durham.
They both went to Duke?
They both went to Duke, and so my dad took a trip to Durham. This is when we're still living in Lauderdale. He got a job at Duke, bought a house. Just all in like a week, and then there was not a time when you could like, hey, let me text you that picture of the house I'm going to buy or whatever.
He just did it.
He just like did it.
He did what a man does.
He's like, we're moving.
Yeah. It's all set.
At least in my memory, that's how it happened. Like, I mean, obviously, I was not consulted as a 12-year-old. So we moved to North Carolina. Yeah, but I find that Florida still kind of like looms large.
Really,
in my mind,
now?
In a weird way. Yeah.
Do you go there?
Hardly ever.
I go, my mother lives in Hollywood, like right out there at Lauderdale, and I've grown to appreciate it, but I still don't know what defines it other than like this weird end of the road element to it.
I feel like there's an old Florida thing that's kind of appealing, and certainly like the nature aspect of it is very appealing, the Everglades and things like that, and the Keys,
we would
get down to the Keys and fishing a lot with my grandfather and stuff like that. Like that looms large, but as a band, actually, we've had some great shows in Florida, and a lot of bands don't go there because either they don't think it's going to be good or because it really adds like a week onto any tour that you're doing.
Florida,
to go down there, to really do it, you got to go down.
Right.
And it takes a while, but if I've found that if you do spend the time, like people will reward you for that. Like they're like, you came here. All right, we're here for you. Like the next time you come, like we'll come see you again.
Well, yeah, because I don't think it's. Like, I never get the feeling that there's a big market for my comedy down there, but they do come out a few people, and they'll come out again. But there's something very homogenized about Florida in its Floridaness.
Yes.
Like, you feel that people that may be like-minded to you or I are either kids or they're stuck there for some reason. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, I get the feeling that most people, they don't even want to go indoors, really, in Florida. You know, they just want to, like, hang out and maybe have a cocktail. It doesn't strike me as this cultural center of things happening unless it's for retired people.
Right, and I hate to dismiss areas like that because, frankly, like, in those kinds of places is where maybe some people are driven to make, like, the weirdest shit.
Yeah,
you know
sure.
what I mean? Because they're like, I'm isolated, but I have ideas.
So you're in junior high, and then did you end up going to college?
Right. So in junior high and high school, I found out about is when I learned about punk rock because there was hardcore bands in Raleigh and Durham and Chapel Hill.
But you were just a mainstream rock guy before.
I was just like
AC/DC.
The Who, AC/DC, mainstream rock, classic rock.
Yeah.
Like I loved it. My dad like had the radio on all the time in the car. Like it was that was what I was into.
Yeah.
And then but there's college radio stations and I heard punk rock on there as well as weird or like 80s things, like Dream Syndicate or bands like that.
Dream Syndicate.
Yeah, stuff like that. Rain Parade.
Days of Ronnie and Roses.
The thing is, like when you tried to go see a band like the Meat Puppets, for instance, I tried to sneak in to see the Meat Puppets on there.
Because you were a kid.
Yeah, but I couldn't get in. The guy from the Meat Puppet,
Which guy?
There's a
Kirk?
Club in, I think it was Kirk. There's a club in Chapel Hill called the Cat's Cradle. It's still there, but this is like in a different location.
Yeah.
It's pretty small, maybe held like 250 people.
Yeah.
And so any band that you heard on college radio, if they're playing in town, that's probably where they were playing. And so Meat Puppets were playing. It's Meat Puppets 2 tour. And I'm like, I'm just going to go. I would try this the dumbest idea. It's like, I'm just going to get in there so early that they won't notice.
I'll sweep over.
Yeah, I'll just like be in there during sound check and just kind of like shrink back in a booth.
I'll go in when they make the keg delivery.
So I'm hanging out outside I was like, I really like your band, but I can't go to the show tonight because I'm not old enough. The guy's like, here, take this guitar. Like hands me the guitar case. He's like, just walk in behind me. I'm like, this is not going to work. I'm going to try it.
Yeah.
Walking in, like I feel a hand on my shoulder as soon as I walk past the guy at the door, Billy. And
is he still there?
He's still there. And he knew that I was, 15 or whatever. And but I was like, it was so cool that they tried to get me in. You know? But anyway, but at hardcore shows, they were all ages shows. And so that was the first bands I could really go see without my parents.
Yeah.
Was like punk rock bands.
Yeah.
And that was such a huge thing for, I think, anyone growing up in that era who got into punk rock.
Who'd you see?
Well, there's a local band called Corrosion of Conformity. Yeah. Still exists.
And, no.
Yeah. And they were not only big in North Carolina, but they became big around the country. And so even when I moved to New York, they would play CBs and sell it out.
But do they still live in North Carolina?
They do. They do. Yeah. And so there's a band called COC. They were kind of the biggest local band. Then, you know, lots of touring punk bands would come through, obviously, like Suicidal Tendencies, Agent Orange, it's like West Coast bands, Bad Brains, like, you know, Descendants, Black Flag, like all these bands would come through, and it was always an all-ages show. So you could see all this stuff, and it was very, like, empowering, not only to be able to go to see bands by yourself with your friends without your parents, but also just to see these people that were much older than you. You're like, oh, I could do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to do that.
And just knocking it out. I mean, it's so smart that they did it all ages. It's interesting because I never really thought about it that way, that the independent spirit of punk rock was completely driven by kids, you know, both playing and saying, like, fuck, we don't need to adhere to club standards. We don't need to try to get booked even. All we got to do is have someone hook us up with a fucking place that can hold 100 people and do it.
Yeah. And so people would put on shows and, you know,
like, where were the shows? Like skate rinks and, you know, Mason Hall.
It's funny. There's a skating rink.
There was?
Yeah. There's a skating rink in Raleigh that had hardcore shows. There's a couple clubs that would do all ages shows and just not sell
alcohol.
During the day. There was one of my favorite shows I ever saw was the Minutemen and with a band called Honor Roll that's from Richmond, Virginia.
You saw the Minutemen?
I saw the Minutemen in a church basement in Durham, this church called St. Joseph's Church.
Wow, must have been after the AA meeting.
And it was like, I mean, I think it's a little too dingy even have an AA meeting in there. It was like it was an unfinished basement,
yeah.
I'd say. But there was a stage in there, and they would have hardcore shows there, and it was incredible just to see this stuff that was like blowing your mind up close.
And these were powerhouse
the
fucking musicians.
Yeah.
I mean, the Minutemen were powerful, man.
Oh, yeah. And they were pretty well known already at that time. That was on the Double Nickels on the Dime tour. And so getting to see that stuff
in
like the
money?
Most random places just made you think, like, anyone can do anything. Like, if I can see the Minutemen in a church basement, anything can happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, were they able to make money or just get by?
I'm sure there were promoters that didn't do right by the bands, but I think for the most part, you're doing a door deal.
Right.
A kid's putting on the show.
Right.
He goes, I'm going to charge $5.
And if
200 people come, you get $1,000 or whatever. I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, they would just get most of the door. Bands would get most of the door. So if no one comes, you're kind of screwed. But if people come, you get paid. And
me can get gas,
yeah,
food.
I mean, I think it was probably pretty different than the idea of like someone actually getting a guarantee.
Right.
You know, of a certain amount of money.
Well, yeah, you're just sort of winging it. And I don't even know how people fucking communicated. You had to set this tour up and trust people. Like, because there was no real internet, right?
No.
So you...
There's not even fax machines at this point.
Yeah, you're just making phone calls.
Yeah.
And some kid's like, yeah, it's cool. Here's the address.
Well, it was...
So you don't know what the fuck you're even driving into.
It was amazing to get a copy of Maximum Rock and Roll, which is like a, you know, hardcore fanzine.
Yeah.
Printed on newsprint. And in the back, there was scene reports. And so, like, anyone, like, you could just write a scene report about your town.
Yeah.
And they publish it, like, scene report for Raleigh. You know, Descendants came through and played an amazing show.
Yeah.
You know, my band Bloodmobile opened. We were awesome. I mean, just kind of like that kind of thing was great. And so, and you'd see that, like, in other towns. Like, oh, my gosh, like, look at what all these people are doing in these other towns. We could do that here. But also, I think that there was a lot of contacts. Like, if you want to book a show in North Carolina, call this guy. And so bands would just do that. And
all
would,
based on this, on Maxim.
Yeah, all on Maximum Rock and Roll, like, you know,
Maximum
Rock and Roll, you find out anything you need in the back of Maximum Rock and Roll at that time. It was incredible. And so people get famous, like promoters, like you'd be like, oh, you're going to do a show in Philly, obviously you're going to do it with this guy, like
yeah.
The guy who does all the Philly shows.
Right.
You know? And so that's how the network was created.
Now, as a guy that stayed in the business and actually found success in a label, I mean, how many of those guys, like on the promoter level or on the musician level, actually continued to build into an empire or into a sort of remain in the business?
I mean, that's a good question, but a lot of the people that, I mean, look, we just played at Coachella, which is a festival that's put on by Golden Voice, at least partially by Golden Voice, which is an LA organization that puts on shows. They have been around since the punk era doing stuff, and now they're putting on the biggest festival in North America, music festival. You know what I mean? And you know, so I do find that, I mean, it's interesting that you asked that question, because I do find that when I think about who I work with and I think about their connections to that era, I go, like, they are from that. Like, so many people do still work in music from that era. who started out maybe putting on all ages shows.
It always fascinates me, especially with people on the other side of the business and the business I'm in, is that as an artist, you know, you don't fucking know what's going to happen to you. You don't know if you're going to nail it. You don't know if you're going to lose. Because as you get older, and you know this as well as I do, you know, people who chose the lives that we have chosen, a lot of people get lost.
Yeah.
A lot of people disappear. A lot of it gets sad. But the guys on the other side of the business, you know what you start to realize about them is like, they had a fucking plan from day one. Our plan was like, we're going to rock, or you know, I'm going to be a great comedian. But they're like, I'm going to build this out. I'm going to have a, you know, an empire.
But who plans that? Who do you think
some
has that
plan?
They do?
I think some people have foresight, especially people who, you know, who understand that the nature of that business. I mean, I think some people luck into it, but I also think like those are the guys, like I never thought about making money. You know, I just assumed it would come. But the dudes that think about making money, that's what they want to do. They want to make money.
But I always had the feeling that if we thought about that, we would definitely not make money. In fact, we would probably just make some terrible decisions, right?
But when you're a promoter, all you're thinking about is making money.
Right, but I think the important thing is that guys that started out booking all ages shows or booking punk shows in their hometowns, they weren't thinking about money then. And by the time they did think about money, they were far enough into it that maybe they had taken something with them from that time period of like, this is how you treat people. I feel like one thing that I really like about having been in a band for so long is that you collect these memories or images of people that you associate with certain clubs like that in the network around the clubs that you played over and over again, whether it's like First Avenue in Minneapolis or Great American Music Hall or in San Francisco, like it's places all over that you just end up playing over and over again, kind of, and you just have like a comfort level there. There might be things you hate about those places or that you love about them, but you're just kind of like, we know how this works.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you just get kind of used to doing this thing. And even though like now, like we don't tour nearly as much as we used to, we hardly tour at all compared to how much we used to tour. And I don't like being away from home because I have a family.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like I do miss that aspect of it, that thing of like, there's a larger community out here that like, even though we're in North Carolina, we're all part of this scene. And like, we know that when we go to Olympia, we see Calvin or whatever, you know, we know that when we're in Austin, we go eat breakfast at this place after every show.
It's great.
You know, like
it's like being in real life. You know, you make the trip, you take a drive.
Yeah,
there they are the old friends. You know, I do that with some, you know, comedy communities. But like, it just seems like that whole thing. I guess it still exists. It's a young man's game, but the feeling of being out in the world and in life and you know, dealing with adversity of just performing in certain places. It's very exciting.
It is, and it's like even though there's, I mean, I go back and forth about it because we definitely play shows now where we were in Helsinki in December and Copenhagen there was a hurricane and it's 5 degrees outside and it's 20 people at the show and
like,
party is like, what are we doing here?
we don't have to do this anymore.
You know what I mean? But then part of me is like,
in Helsinki.
Yeah, but the 20 people that are here are like the best fans we've ever had because they're here. There's a hurricane. The government has told people to stay in their houses, yet these people are like at our show at this squat.
How was the show?
I mean, I thought it was great, and you might ask other people in the band, they might have a different idea about that. But that was
back in the day. You were at a squat?
No, this is in December. This is like last December.
Superchunk is playing a squat in Helsinki during a hurricane. You're still living it, Mac.
I mean, you know, part of me is like, oh my God, we're still living it. And part of me is like, we're still living it. You know, it's like, it's a two-sided thing that I think that we kind of are reckoning with all the time. Like, what is worth doing at this point?
Right.
You know what I mean?
But okay, well, let's go back, though. So you start playing in junior high and high school. You get your first, guitar. You're in a band that's based around the sound of an Ovation breadwinner.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what's your old man's feelings about what you're doing?
My parents were very supportive of, like, the whole thing. It's kind of amazing. Like, I had nothing to rebel against in that sense.
Did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to Columbia in New York.
You did?
Yeah.
For the full ride?
Yeah.
You're a smart guy.
So I lived in New York from like 85 to 90.
How does that go? So you throughout high school, you're playing in bands, and obviously you're not a fucking disaster. You got the grades and the push to go to Columbia, so you're managing your life. You're not a drunk. You're not throwing it away.
Right.
And you're playing in bands, but Superchunk is not formed until after college?
Superchunk's not formed. Like, I was in a band in high school, and like our biggest gig, which was genuinely big for us was opening for Tommy Keen at the Cat's Cradle, which was
I remember him.
Awesome. Tommy's great. And but we did we did our own songs, but also, you know, you're covers. Echoing the Bunny Men covers, you know, Pretenders covers. Pneumatic Underground.
There you go.
Very high school band name, right?
Uh-huh.
And then in college I had that band Wax and also a band called Slush Puppies, but those bands were in North Carolina, so we would just play when I was home on vacation kind of thing.
During the summer.
Yeah.
So you didn't record with them?
Recorded some singles, and before we started Merge...
Who recorded the singles? Did you guys self-produce them? How's that work?
We recorded them at this, mainly at this studio called Duck Key Studios, which is in Raleigh. It's just in this guy's house, a similar situation to this, you know, just like set up in his house, 16, or maybe it started as 8-track and then 16-track, and all the bands recorded there, and the guy, Jerry Key, who's the engineer, he still has a studio in his house. He moved it out in the country a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He was just great to work with, and he's like, any band that came in, you know, he's like, I'm game to do whatever you weirdos are going to do in here. You know what I mean? Because there were some weird bands. And it was great having that resource of like a cheap place to record. And the fact that it was in someone's house, I think, took some of the mystery out of it. Like, no one could psych you out and make you feel like you didn't know what you're doing because you're in their studio.
Right.
He was just like, no, we're just we're just recording your music. You know?
Right, right.
There's nothing crazy going on.
Yeah.
And so, and we all ended up, we'd put a box set together of 7 inches by all these bands right before we started Merge. So it's like 87, 88. Myself, a guy named Wayne Taylor, a couple named Bill and Barbara printed the silkscreen, the covers. They have a silkscreen company. They make t-shirts for bands.
So this was a business idea that you had to do regional bands in a box set.
I think it was like all of us together thought like, all these bands exist now. We're probably all going to break up in a year or something like that.
And this is after college or during?
This is during.
Yeah.
Like, let's put out some... Let's make an artifact, basically. Yeah. And so we made a box set of 5 7-inches, one by each of these bands, and then had a couple like record release shows where we played, all the bands played, and we put out the records. And Wayne kind of knew how all this worked, this guy Wayne, who's also in Wax. And that whole thing kind of demystified the record-making process for us, because we're like, oh, like you just send the tapes to the pressing plant.
United Record
and then you
pressing?
Get them back.
Did
United,
you do it?
No, we did it a different place. We didn't start using United until we started Merge.
I learned a whole lesson taking that tour of United. Like, you know,
that's amazing.
They're almost like, they're like Sweden. They're non-denominational. They don't have any politics.
Yeah.
They'll press whatever comes in, man. If you're going to pay for the record, they'll press the record.
I think one of the only issues we ever had was that there was a record that had a picture of Elvis on the label.
Uh-huh.
That was a Rocket from the Crypt 7-inch.
Yeah.
And I think they're like,
Can't do it.
We can't put Elvis on the. We can't put a picture of Elvis on here. Like, you don't have the rights to that.
Right. So yeah. We don't want to get in trouble.
I think we did that somewhere else.
All right, so you figure it out. You demystify the process. And so you graduate college and you're like, I'm fucking in.
And that's when we started Merge. Like, we started Merge about the year before I graduated.
But did you start it before Superchunk?
We did, because I was in a band in college just with my roommates, basically, called Bricks. And we just recorded on a 4-track, played live a few times. The space at Chase, that was another club downtown, but we played it also at the CB's Canteen, which is next to CB's.
It's like the gallery now, CB's gallery, yeah.
So
it's not there, none of it's there anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
So I had this band Bricks that was like our bedroom thing. And when we started Merge, the first thing we put out was a cassette by Bricks. And again, it was more like, it wasn't like, all right, we're going to put this out and become like a band. It was more like, we went to the trouble of writing these songs, let's just document this thing and put it out there. So then
the idea of the label at that time. I mean, since you're a musician, you had the band and everything, but you obviously this was the time of indie labels as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was starting, correct?
Yeah.
That was a viable way to get your shit out in the world before the internet and before to sort of work around major labels and trying to find a way to distribute your own music.
Right, because I guess for us what was not appealing was the idea of let's make a demo and then hope that someone else will be interested. Well, it's like, we're already interested ourselves, so like, let's just do it ourselves. You know, like, why have that extra step and like hope someone else is into
it? But did you think you would make money?
No. It was really just like it was almost just like an art project.
Right.
It's like, we recorded this stuff ourselves, let's put it out ourselves, and then, you know, make 100 tapes. It's not a big investment.
It was on tape.
You know what I mean? Yes, cassette only. First two releases were cassettes. We didn't have enough money to press records.
Do you still have them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then,
do you have boxes?
No,
of them?
We literally had like a dubbing deck, you know, like.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was like our first big expenditure as a label, was to buy a dubbing deck to sit there and run cassettes off at like high speeds. I'm sure they sound terrible. So we did a Wax cassette and a Bricks cassette. then we borrowed some money from a friend of ours named Lydia Ely, who lives in San Francisco now, and she lent us money for the first Chunk single. Or maybe it was the Metal Pitcher single, which was a band that Laura and I had before Chunk existed. On vinyl, 7 inches.
It's so funny to me that like everything we're talking about, it doesn't exist anymore. That like obviously records do, but yeah. The ability to record your own music, the idea that you got 4-track, you got to go to analog,
yeah,
and then you're gonna have to rip it onto cassette and then fucking dub those cassettes or get the masters to a label. But everything was sort of like there was just machinery around.
Yeah, there was machinery for sure. Exactly. It was all very like hand. Put together everything. Yeah. You know,
and you're cutting things on a splicer sometimes.
Oh yeah, you're at Kinko's like making
labels,
running off the labels on a Xerox machine, and then peeling them off and sticking them on the cassette. I mean. Yeah, it's hilarious.
All right, so you borrow some money for the vinyl release.
And we start doing 7 inches. And so then the first series of 7 inches was like either by Chunk, which was our band was called at the time, or by other local bands. And sometimes even they would put up like half the money to have the thing pressed. And then we would sell them and then pay the band back. But it wasn't, again, it wasn't really like, oh, if we sell this, we can make some money. It was just like, let's just hopefully we make our money back.
Right.
And don't lose
and
money.
And sometimes you'd have to, the band would buy like a couple hundred copies to tour with, right?
Yeah, sure. The band sell them on tour. That was like kind of their payment was like, okay, you get 10% of the pressing.
Right.
You're not going to get any money from us, but like you get 10% of the pressing, you sell those on tour, maybe that's your money that you
make. Right.
But mostly we were all just like, we have a record with our name on it. Was all we
and
really
cover
wanted.
Art.
Yeah, we get to do the cover art.
Yeah.
So that was like the most exciting thing about it. And it just kind of grew from there to the point where, we could sell enough to make enough to press the next thing we were doing. And at the time, I mean, this is one thing that's really different from now. At the time, if you put out a 7-inch that was good and got reviewed in a few fanzines and played on a few college radio stations, you could get noticed.
Right.
In a way. Like, we did our first Superchunk tour with 2 7-inches out. Now, like, you put out 2 7-inches, I don't know how anyone hears about that.
Right.
You know, because there's just so much stuff.
Always a lot of stuff you got to wade through.
Yeah, and I feel like at the time it was a little bit easier.
Smaller world.
It was a smaller world, and even though there's a lot more record stores, those record stores had, you know, people would actually like look through the 7-inches and see what the new 7-inches were.
And now what was the shift in the name from Chunk to Super Chunk?
Well, there's a band in New York, kind of a knitting factory associated band called Chunk.
Right.
Sam Bennett is like a percussionist, and he had this band called Chunk. And around the time we were talking to Gerard Cosway about signing to Matador, he said, you know, there's this band called Chunk in New York already. And we were like, oh, he's like, well, he said, I can ask them if you can also use the name because you're so different. It's not,
right.
That's more of like an improv thing and you guys are rock band. And he came back and said, no, he says you can't use it.
Right.
So we had to just come up with something, and it's really hard to come up with band names.
So why were you meeting with Matador if you were self-releasing?
Because all we could do was singles. Like, all we could afford to do was singles, and we wanted to put out an album. So in our mind, like, we can't do an album. Like, that's like making CDs and LPs and cassettes and, like, you know,
The infrastructure, the business infrastructure was not something you guys had in mind.
We just didn't have it.
And,
but we also knew that we loved Homestead, where Gerard had been. And we wanted to be on his label.
Matador is a big label.
Yeah, we were. I mean, at the time, it was Gerard and Chris, and maybe one or two other people. And because Gerard was just starting it after leaving Homestead, it obviously became like an amazing label.
Well, that's interesting because those, you know, like between Pavement and Guided by Voices and you guys, there was, it's interesting that it all evolved out of this punk rock sensibility, but it sort of redefined what became alternative rock, I guess, and which was really more pop driven than punk.
Yeah, I think that one thing that we had always, I mean, we talked about Husker Du. I mean, Husker Du is like a punk band that had very melodic songs,
right.
And like that combination was always kind of what appealed to me anyway. Like Buzzcocks,
right?
Husker Du, like I certainly liked stuff that was purely loud and fast, and you know, just goes by in a blinding second without any melody in particular, but I really latched on to those bands. I mean, a band like Dinosaur Jr. is like so melodic. It's like all melodies. The guitar solos are melodies. The vocals are melodies. It's like it's all beautiful.
It's like
someone
said, hey, there are minor chords. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's just like,
we can get past 3 chords. We can add a couple.
Well, it's real songs, you know? And I think that that's what has allowed us to still exist as a band even is that we were based on songs more than like a sound or a
right
anything else, you know.
All right, so you signed, how many records did you do at Matador?
So we did 3 records with Matador, and then
that built our following.
And by that point Merge had also grown to a point where we could do full lengths on Merge. Merge started working with a label in Chicago called Touch and Go.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of gave us the infrastructure to do full length records. And so we started doing obviously our own records, but also a band called Polvo from North Carolina was one of the first full lengths we did. Magnetic Fields from Boston was one of the first full lengths we did. Band called Lamb Chop from Nashville. And we even started working with bands from overseas, like the 3Ds from New Zealand. Like once you can do full length albums, then it opens you up to being able to say to a band, like, we can really put out your record,
right,
and not just do your single.
And what'd you do for distribution?
So we had, Touch and Go was a distributor.
Okay.
And they would, so it was like a manufacturing distribution deal, basically.
And who was producing the records?
The bands, always.
Oh, it was all self-produced.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, that's one thing that we've always kind of left. I mean, that's what I always assumed. That's how I assumed things worked in punk rock, was that, like, you're the band, like, you make the decisions, like, you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. like, if we love your band, it's because we like your ideas, so, like, why would we then say, you should really work with so-and-so to
right.
make this next record, you know,
right,
because
then you're a suit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So the bands would generally just turn in their record when it was done, be like, here's our record.
They'd go record it on their own.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it just started like that. And then, you know, like once you end up working with a few great bands, then you have a good reputation because people are like, I love Magnetic Fields. I'd like to work with those people. But I think that we still saw Superchunk as like our job.
Right.
I mean, as like our main thing.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. You're a rock band.
Yeah. We're touring, you know, 3 or 4 months out of the year, probably sometimes maybe more, and making records like at a pretty rapid pace that eventually slowed down in the late 90s just because I think we just got burnt out on that cycle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you did a bunch of records and you're getting older.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Worcester's running around playing for everybody.
That's right. John has like a multifaceted career in music, comedy,
yeah.
writing,
yeah.
you know what I mean? Acting.
And you've known him forever?
I've known John, I think I met John, I've known John's brother for longer than I've known John's older brother, Lane, but John I met through Lane, but also through friends in Chapel Hill. And when I saw his band play at one point, he was playing with a band called the Accelerators. And so I'd seen him play drums. And then when things didn't seem to be working out with Chuck, our first drummer, after doing a couple albums and some good deal of touring, someone recommended John. And I was like, wow, like I've seen him play. He's awesome. You know?
Yeah.
And so we got in touch, and I don't remember how many rehearsals we had before the first show that he played, but it was not very many. And so that was, I guess, 91, I think.
So how does it become, because I feel, I mean, you guys are, you know, it's like me in comedy. It's like that's where your heart is. That's what you came up in. But at some point, I have to imagine that the label became the bread and butter of you know, how you were making a living.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Laura and I didn't pay ourselves for Merge until 8 or 9 years into the label existing.
The bass player?
Yeah, yeah.
Were you guys romantically involved?
We were when we started both those things, the band and the label.
Uh-huh.
How
did that end?
And so we were a couple. It ended protractedly, I would say. And so we were a couple until 93, I guess.
That must have been crazy.
It's kind of crazy, but it is also that thing of like, when you're on, obviously it seemed much more monumental then.
Yeah.
Even though now you think about it and it's like a 4 or 5 year period in your life is
yeah.
not such a big deal. But of course it was like a big deal, and we spent all our time around each other
because yeah.
we had the label and the band, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we're not doing anything else.
Yeah.
Except being around each other. So obviously it was weird, and probably even weirder for John and Jim at that point, you know what I mean? Like, what's the deal with you two? What are you doing? but you know, we never really had an idea to break up the band or stop the label. Like, it was just kind of like, well, this...
How'd you end up so fucking grown up?
This isn't done.
Where's the drama?
I mean, this isn't working anymore, but we spent so much time and energy on these other two things. Why would we also toss that out? You know what I mean?
And you got along still.
Well, I mean, that's... maybe not putting it a little bit more smoothly than it actually went for a while. But I mean, I think that we certainly get along now, and I think that even—
Do your kids hang out with each other?
Not all the time, but I mean, if we're all out at like a rock festival together outside,
right.
like the farmer's market or something like that.
Do they live in the neighborhood kind of deal?
No, because Laura lives in Durham.
Okay.
And we live in Chapel Hill, right. So it's not like walking distance.
And you married a famous chef.
I did. I have to say, she was not famous when I married her, so I didn't marry her for her fame.
Yeah, you weren't climbing by marrying
right.
a chef in North Carolina.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Her restaurant's very good, by the way.
Andrea's chef, and she has a great restaurant called Lantern. But
in Chapel Hill, it's very good.
In Chapel Hill,
I'll plug her restaurant. I can vouch for the restaurant. All right, so here you are. You're
we're no longer a couple, but we still have these two things that are both going pretty strong at that point. And so we just kind of, I would just say we just kind of plowed through. You know what I mean? And like touring kind of sucked with the person that you just broke up with after going out with for 5 years. But again, we just kind of. I mean, one thing about touring is that you're already kind of like on everyone's nerves that's all around you. So it's just one more person to be on the nerves of, you know what I mean?
So I've not talked to somebody who has a record label. So how do you, like, you know, who were the original bands when you really sort of felt it was becoming a business and you were starting to make money? So you had Superchunk, and who else was on the label?
So we're talking mid-90s, Polvo, Magnetic Fields, 3Ds. We did the first Corner Shop record, a band called Butter Glory.
Yeah.
Lamb Chop.
Uh-huh.
We eventually worked with Neutral Milk Hotel. That was, I think the first record was 96, maybe.
I never got them.
And they were great yesterday at Coachella, by the way. They were amazing. And the roster just kind of grew and grew. Beatnik Film Stars, a band from England that we worked with.
So you're doing all right.
Yeah. So the label's kind of growing, and a couple of things were kind of milestones for us. One was the Magnetic Fields record called 69 Love Songs, which was the kind of perfect thing. He had made great records before, but doing something that on kind of an audacious scale, literally like writing 69 love songs.
Yeah.
Which I think was supposed to be 100, and then he just shortened it to 69 because that seemed more doable somehow.
Yeah.
Putting out a 3-CD box set of like all original songs was just like, it was like a news story for people. It was like a way to try to get their minds around this guy, Stephen Merritt, who's writing these incredible songs. And it's so solid for a record that has 69 songs on it.
Yeah.
It's like you can actually just listen to it. You're not skipping over songs,
right.
You know what I mean? And that was, at that time, became like our biggest selling record. And I mean, I remember at the time he said, you know, we want to be a box set, and together with Touch and Go, we kind of thought like, man, like, okay, we'll make like 2,000 of the box set because that's for like the hardcore fans, and other people are just going to want to buy like one, two, or three. Like they're not going to go all in.
Right.
But the box set just went crazy and we couldn't make enough. And so, you know, that thing ended up selling like over 100,000 copies.
Wow.
Yeah. Which for us at the time was like, again, like this is, I've always thought that like while we're in the music business, we're not really in like what people think of as the music business, because for the music business at large, 100,000 records is not a lot of records,
right.
But for us it was like life changing.
Yeah.
Like what the you know, like crazy.
Yeah.
And so that was amazing for us, and then that followed soon after by Neutral Milk Hotel in the Aeroplane Over the Sea, which became a hugely important record for like a ton of people. And still is, as is evidenced by the touring that band can do now, this many years later.
But do you still have the rights of that record?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, okay, so you actually have, you know, between some of the people that have evolved into larger bands, you still have some of that catalog.
Yeah, and I feel like that is, again, kind of going, even though like none of these records are punk rock records, but going back to the idea of like, what did you learn from punk? Well, you know, like treating people well that you work with.
Right.
Not being an asshole, and the fact that like as someone in a band, like you value the artist that you're working with, and you know, having been on record labels, you know what you do and don't want from a record label,
right?
As an artist, right?
Yeah.
You know how you want to be treated and how you don't want to be treated, and I think that leads to relationships that we have with artists where we're still working with them 20 years later, 30 years later.
Unbelievable. You know? So but after the success, I mean, what were the struggles in terms of like, well, how do we, was there conversations of, Do we need a bigger distributor? Do we need to, you know, partner up with, you know, with a major label? I mean, I don't really know how that works because I know Matador now is part of Beggars Group. And I don't even know how that kind of thing happens.
I mean, that conversation kind of came at us from the other side, major labels coming to us saying like, hey, how can we work together?
Right.
And our attitude was always like, we can't work together because we've seen how that goes. and not to be a jerk about it, but I just mean like there was literally never a time when we were like, we need help or we need cash infusion.
And you weren't greedy.
Well, right. And also like, talk about like a fuck you to everyone that you've ever worked with. Like, oh, we signed to Merge and now we're on what label?
Sony.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So. Yeah. It really wasn't ever tempting, though. There was certainly, and the people that we were talking to were like very nice people who were into music. It's not like you're just talking to someone who's like, I'm looking at your bottom line, seeing that we can make some money.
Sure.
Like they're into the bands.
Right.
But like, it just didn't make sense for us ever to do that.
But all the bands were coming to you because they liked bands who were on the label primarily.
I mean, I think that as the label gets bigger, obviously some people are just like, we've heard of Merge, like,
Let's do it. They're interested.
Yeah, but
that's always the weird thing about the artists, sort of like someone likes us. Let them put the record out. They like us.
I mean, I think that it did have a lot to do with it though, because I think that I mean, even, you know, Wynn from the Arcade Fire said that, like, you know, they were fans of the Magnetic Fields, you know.
Mike, you put out all the Arcade Fire records.
Yeah.
Those are big records.
They are big records. They're our biggest records for sure.
What about, and how did, you were with Spoon early on?
Yep, we did, Spoon was on Matador.
Yeah.
And then signed to a major label, which just decidedly did not go well for them, and then were dropped. And then we started working with them right after that, and then we did their next.
You did big records with them?
Yeah.
So was there ever a time where business wasn't good? Or
from
the mid-90s, did it just kind of build out?
It kind of built out, but there's obviously like mixed in, there's kind of just off years depending on what came out that year. And I think that one thing that we've always been good at and caution is kind of like, that's really Laura's department, like being cautionary and conservative when it comes to spending money.
Yeah.
Or hiring or spending money on marketing or whatever, all the things, decisions you have to make. Was that we've never been real crazy about that. We've never tried to grow too fast.
Right.
I mean, maybe we've actually grown too slow in some situations and not been able to keep up with stuff the way we could have been able to. But on the plus side, that means that, like, if we do have a down year, we're kind of prepared for it because we've never gotten so big that, like, oh my God, like, if we don't sell this many,
hemorrhaging money,
we have to start firing people or something. You know what I mean?
How big is the operation?
I mean, believe me, I have that dream all the time that, like, that's going to happen. But knock on wood, so far, like, it's grown at a pace that we can deal with.
And how big's the operation now?
So I think there's 18 people that work there now, including Laura and I. Yeah, offices in Durham. Yeah, actually our designer lives in Canada. She moved from Durham to Canada, but she's great, so we
and
kept
you,
her.
And now you have how many bands on the label?
I can never answer that question because like there's so many bands and there's like a certain amount of active bands and then there's bands that like, they're still on Merge, even though they haven't put out a record in 5 or 6 years, you know.
And what's your relationship with them? Do you ever ask them, like, what's going on, fellas?
We check in. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like
I got nothing.
It's a wide variety of people that we work with, you know, like East River Pipe. I don't know if we've sent you any of that, if you've heard that, but it's a guy named Fred Cornog who lives in New Jersey. He's never played live.
Yeah.
He's never toured.
Yeah.
He's put out amazing records, and he just records them at home at his own pace. And so, like, when the record's ready, like, we get a record, you know what I mean? And so there's that, everything from that to bands that are like, really, like, we're making a record, here's how we want the rollout to happen, here's when we're touring, like, you know, like planned out down to like the dot.
But with somebody like Arcade Fire, that's such a huge band now, you know, what's your involvement with that? And they, you know, who's the distributor on that?
So the distributor on the new one is Capitol, which is different than it has been in the past.
Well, what's your relationship with Capitol? How does that relationship happen?
We don't really have a relationship with Capitol other than we're like, the band does, exactly. Yeah. So we're working with the band and Capitol all together on this.
But they're
new
signed
record.
To you.
Yeah.
So you do a percentage split with Capitol?
We do, yes. Yeah. And with the band. Like it's all.
And that's big distribution, though. I mean, that helps you in the long run.
You know, it helps. Hopefully it helps everyone.
Yeah.
That's the idea. But I think what the band really wanted to do was just to make sure that, I mean, they have grand ideas, you know, like they do things on a large scale and they wanted to make sure that that was all going to happen on the scale that they wanted it to happen. And That the records were going to be everywhere and the marketing was going to be everywhere.
Right.
Which is, I mean, that is slightly out of our wheelhouse for the way that we normally right. do things. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, it's like, I feel like we relate to Arcade Fire like we relate to all the other bands we work with as, like, you know, partners in a way, you know? I mean, it's like I'm always hesitant to give Merge credit, really, just because without the bands, like, we're not doing anything. You know what I mean? Like, they send us amazing records to put out, and then it's our job to make sure people know about it.
Okay, so you walked, you know, you came through my house. You see that I'm recently re-obsessed, or more obsessed than I've ever been, with vinyl. I mean, what is your relationship with actual vinyl records? Has that business changed now? I mean, is it really happening again? Are people buying records? How do you feel? Like, because I know a lot of your business has to be digital, but I mean, you send me records. What's your relationship with records?
Well, it's funny because I always have to ask. I didn't have to ask you because I listen to your podcast, but mostly I have to ask someone, like, hey, I want to send you some music. Like, how do you want it? Like,
right.
CDs, LPs,
right.
or just a download? Some people are like, download's great.
Yeah.
But, like, I have, like, my relationship with vinyl is kind of what it always has been, is, like, I buy a lot of it. I love listening to it. And I find that I become much more attached to any record that I get on vinyl than I ever do if I just... I mean, I use iTunes. I think it's a great service, actually. And we obviously sell a lot of records on iTunes. But I forget what I have in my computer. Like, I don't, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, my hard drive full of shit that I never listened to.
It's just in there somewhere. And I love my iPod for the convenience of it. But MP3s, frankly, do hurt my ears after a while.
They do. You have to readjust the vinyl. Because you're like, even listening to it, you're like, how come it's not as satisfying? It's because, like, digital music's like crack. I mean, you can just blast it out. It's all coming at the same fucking, you know, momentum.
Yeah, typed up in this weird way.
But, like, the nuance of listening to stuff on vinyl is like, oh, okay. It was smaller than that.
And I feel like it's a time relationship. Because, you know, like, if we would go downtown to get the new album by the fall, for instance.
Yeah.
Maybe you could afford to buy like two or three records.
Yeah.
You bring them back and you're like, that's what you're listening to for the next week.
Right.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
And you have to stay near, like, you physically have to be near the turntable to turn the thing over.
Yeah.
So you're not just like, I'm putting this on and then just do 100 things.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm putting this on, I'm like listening to this record. Like,
yeah.
And I've found that, because our CD player broke like a while ago.
Yeah.
And before getting a new one, I was like, oh, wow, we're just, like, listening to records all the time now. Like, this is awesome, you know what I mean? And I feel like I said, I think it's a time relationship, because if you're listening to a record for the time it takes to, like, listen to it, flip it over, listen to the other side, you have to look at the cover at some point in there. Like, that is time you've spent with that music that is, like, devoted to that music. Even if you're, like, paying your bills or whatever while it's on, like, you have to be close by and you're involved in the
right.
process.
Yeah.
And so,
and it does sound different.
Yeah, it does. It does sound different, and it's a different feeling. And I feel like part of to answer your question about how is vinyl doing, vinyl is selling really well compared to how it was for a while there.
Yeah,
I think the new Supertrunk record has sold maybe a third vinyl, a third CD, and a third digital.
Uh-huh.
That's not necessarily typical for all the records we put out, but
right.
like, so vinyl is selling a lot more than it used to. In the, say, late 90s, early 2000s, but it's not selling enough to replace all the people that aren't buying anything anymore. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's a two-edged sword. Everyone's like, vinyl's back. I'm like, it's back, but it's not back enough
right.
to save everything.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I feel like it's awesome in the sense that it's creating what's part of our thing that we have to do as a label, I think, is create a relationship between people and the music that they feel strongly about, to the point where they don't feel like, I should just have this for free. Or, like, this doesn't mean anything to me. Like, this means the same as, like, that coffee I just threw away.
Right.
Like, I feel like we have to create an emotional relationship for people between the music, or just give them the way to have that relationship. We can't create the relationship.
Well, I mean, it's weird because you and I grew up with it. I mean, it's part of our DNA to buy records. And, you know, I got away from it, obviously, for years. But once it's back, it's back.
It's hard to stop once it's back.
Well, yeah, because you're looking at them like, oh, it's my records.
Well, and now there's so many more things available now. It's like, yeah, I never really had a chance to buy an album of Nigerian disco from 1979. But now I can buy like 10 volumes of that if I want to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, my God, like, now there's too many things I want. And,
right.
But I guess my point is that, like, I feel like the reason that it's back is both people like you and I that maybe stopped for a while and came back to it, but also people who never had that in the first place, and they're like, this is fun.
It is.
You know, like, this is fun. And
fun
so,
to look at records.
And I think that Record Store Day is, again, I have conflicted feelings about it because it's once a year.
Yeah.
And everyone goes crazy about it.
Right.
Puts out really cool stuff.
Yeah.
And people stand in line starting at dawn or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm just hoping, like, people come back like every now and then,
right?
Or is it just this one like frenzy?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're like, wow, I can't wait till next year.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Which
I don't know.
That's not a solution.
Well, I just like the barter element too. Is that like all those records that everybody stopped playing in the '90s through now are out in the world somewhere? So
yeah.
The interesting thing about going to used record stores and digging stuff up is like there's no shortage to it because you know you're looking at how many records were sold in the periods where records were sold. You know, many of them are gone or many of them are damaged, but there's still this never-ending ecosystem of boxes of fucking records that show up, and I love it.
You know what I like finding is records that came out in the '80s.
Yeah,
that then people replaced on CD. They're like, I'm getting the CD of this, and
right.
traded in all their
right.
records in
right.
that whole wave of like everyone
That's right.
replacing their stuff on
That's
CDs,
right.
because there's some stuff there that then maybe went out of print altogether.
Right,
that you can find those LPs that people traded in.
Do you see a time where you're just going to be like, no, maybe we'll go out with Superchunk once or twice a year?
I mean, I really go back and forth on that because if I'm not doing music,
yeah.
I start to go a little crazy. Like, I don't think I could just do the label. I don't
right.
think I could just do the business.
Yeah,
like, you know, I have a studio in my basement. And like I'm writing songs all the time, and whether it ends up being a Superchunk record or not is whether I can kind of like rope everyone in. My thing was like, I would love to make another record with Superchunk. I think we all would on some level, maybe some more than others, maybe me the most.
Yeah.
But only do it if it's going to be awesome, because if someone waits 10 years and go like, oh, you made a record after 10 years and it's just not that good, like that would be the worst.
But that one's well received.
Oh yeah, they've both been really well received, and it's very gratifying. As John said recently, you know, I think that people have an idea that we were bigger than we were in the '90s than
right.
we actually were.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like we're going to tour the world doing like reunion shows on some larger level. So it really is more for us.
It's interesting to me because I talk to a lot of guys that have, you know, had arced out and, you know, sadly, mainstream music is so youth driven that when people like you who obviously become craftsmen and become, you know, mature artists, it is quite possible and probably probable that you are on some level doing the best work you've ever done. But the sort of context of it is different. That, you know, it's
right.
not, you know, it's not some, you know, hot, sexy, you know, kind of rage or youth driven type of thing, but it actually should be better now. And then just by virtue of the way,
because you know what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
But by nature of the music market, you know, all of a sudden when you finally matured to where you need to be, the audience is now either your age
right.
or is hard to access.
Yeah. And I mean, it's very gratifying when you see people at shows that are young.
Yeah.
You're like, yes, it's not just... It's not just us, you know what I mean, that we're playing to.
Yeah, we're not some sort of weird you know, nostalgia tour for the 1,200 people that we have nationwide.
But at the same time, you see people that have been coming to see you since 1990 or
yeah.
whatever, and you go like, I love you.
Yeah.
Like, how could I not love you for coming to see us for 24 years?
Nice to see you guys.
So you can't discount any of it. You know, someone asked me yesterday, like, how long are you going to keep, like, pogoing on stage or whatever, you know? And I was like... Well, I don't know. Like, sometimes I do think, like, is it just humiliating? Like, is it just, like, embarrassing? Like, who's the old guy jumping around on stage like he's not old?
Hey, I think you got to go with what you feel.
Yeah.
If you still feel it, do it.
You're right. Sometimes yeah. I feel it and then later rethink that feeling, but I think that, like,
yeah,
I think you're right.
If the feeling is genuine, yeah, just do it. I mean, yeah, there's nothing not humiliating about most of life.
That's true, and I think that one thing, that's true, and I think that one thing about being in a band long enough to not give a shit whether it's humiliating or not
yeah.
is kind of like one of the rewards.
Yeah, that's the big win. Like,
you know?
Yeah, hey, I don't care if I'm embarrassing myself. I'm having a good time. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Back in the old days, it was just fuck you. Now it's like, fuck you, I'm having fun.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, thanks, Mac.
Thank you.
That's it, folks. That's our show. I hope you enjoyed that. Carol Leifer, special guest, Mac McCann. Good to talk music business for the first time, really. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Check the schedule, get the app, upgrade the premium app, stream all 500 and some odd WTF episodes. Oh, God. What else? What else? JustCoffee.coop, available at WTFpod.com. Get the WTF blend. I get a little on the back end there. Oh, my God. Check the calendar. Did I say that already? Got a lot of gigs coming up. I'm sweating here. I'm sweating in the garage. It's hot. Oh, my God. So much is going so well. But the personal stuff is so hard. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.